Welcome back to Shattering This. I do want to turn to Paul now. Islam is not the only dark and demonic menace to the world today. Christianity, while not even remotely as violent, while not promoting terrorist acts, it is still deadly on souls. It is responsible for the deaths of more souls than is Islam, only because more people have been victimized by it. That's why Yahweh called Christianity the plague of death. Nothing that man has ever promoted has had such a devastating influence on human souls. Shaul's next statement, that would be Paul to Christians, is also untrue. Feeding the myth of predestination, I've shared this passage with you, but we'll read it again and move on. And also this mythos, which not only became Calvinism, but really is the mythos that is germane to Roman Catholicism as well. When you study the writings of Saint Augustine, using their vernacular, he was also into predestination. The moment you move into predestination, you show that you are incapable of logical thought. And he also makes a number of just stupid statements. Here, this was the statement. We discussed it at length yesterday. We'll move on today. But at a point in time, it pleased for God, the one having appointed me, setting me aside out of the womb of my mother, to reveal and disclose the Son of Him in order that I could announce the healing message among the ethnicities immediately. I did not ask advice or consult with flesh or blood. Everything he said is untrue. God does not appoint people in the womb. God did not appoint him. He did not reveal anything that was true about the Son. He did not do so immediately. And he did ask the advice of and consult with and learn from men. It's typical of Paul. Everything he said is untrue. In Galatians 1, 15 and 16. Unpolished in the Nestle Aland interlinear, Paul's words as he wrote them read, "But when but thought, well the God, the one having separated me from stomach of mother, of me, and having called through the favor of him to uncover the Son of him in me, that I might tell good message, him in the nations immediately, not I conferred in flesh and blood." That's what he wrote. If you're a Christian, and that's part of your New Testament, and you think it's the inerrant word of God, then you are stupid. Then your God is an idiot. Shaul wants us to believe that God not only chose him, but did so even before he was born. And yet, since this only occurred with Yahusha, and only because he wasn't actually born, but simply manifest for our benefit, Shaul is lying by putting himself on par with God, and even one step beyond God's prophets, Yirmiyah. It is one thing to God to have known us before we were born, as that simply attests to his nature as light, where he sees the past, the present, and the future, all as if they exist in the immediate, right now. But choice is sacrosanct to God. The entire process, purpose of the universe and the Torah is for us to have the opportunity and thus the choice to know and to love God or to be ignorant of him and even reject him, be opposed to him. Those options are ours and they necessitate free will. Even with Abraham and Moshe, arguably the most important individuals in human history, Yahweh asked them. He did not appoint them. That is not to say, however, that Yahweh is unaware of Shaul, of Paul. As I've already shared, there are two very foreboding prophecies about him, and in due time, we will expose many more very specific predictions pertaining to the most influential man who ever lived. Paul will soon speak of a three-year fanciful sojourn to Arabia, the heartland of the Torah, where he claims to have met with God. And yet, while the timeline prepared by the historian Luke in Acts makes this trip impossible, the very notion of preparation is contrary to what this passage asserts. While Paul's message does not change in that it is nothing more than a rejection of the Torah and an advocacy for his gospel of grace, and while Paul's condescending attitude and circuitous style do not change, amongst his letters or between his letters in the book of Acts, it is readily apparent that Paul has become a pathological liar, and a liar with a faulty memory. He will say one thing at one time and something entirely different, contradicting what he previously said. He is not only a pathological liar, he's a very poor memory. And what did they say? You know, that the hardest thing about lying is remembering what you said. And if you simply tell the truth, you don't have to remember. You know, you just recall what actually happened. But when you lie, you always create a variation. And then you have to remember what you told people about the variation, your recreation of what occurred. And so remembering what you said is the most difficult part of lying. I remember that was a time when I was quite young, and I was engaged in, you know, as a minor deception. You know how we are with parents. Somebody, a parent, would ask you something, or it might have been a teacher, you know, did you do this, that, and the other thing. And when I was very young, I came up with a story. And I remember distinctly the difficulty I had remembering what I had said, so that my recollection and response to future questions was consistent. And I remember how much work it was and how difficult it was. And I had a pretty good mind at the time to remember my lie and how my lie differed from the actual truth. It had such an effect on me. I said, you know, this is just not worth it. I'm much rather better off trying to justify what actually happened than I am trying to deceive people in this regard. But Paul was not only a pathological liar, he had a faulty memory. Combination of those two is a really bad combination. He began, remember, his letter in Galatians 1:1 with Paulos, an apostle and messenger who was dispatched not from men, not even by means of man, which would only be true if Gamaliel, Israel's most acclaimed teacher, was not a man, and if Judaism was not a man-made religion. Then in Galatians 1:12, when he continued with, "But I profess to you, brothers, of the beneficial messenger, which having been communicated by myself, because it was not in accord with man." This would mean that Paul was lying when he said that he was in full accord with the strictest application of the religious traditions of Judaism, as he confessed in Acts 22:3. Also, his follow-on statement, "But neither because I by man associating myself with it, nor was I taught," would have to be dishonest if he told the truth about the many years he spent in the classroom learning how to argue against the Torah in rabbinical school at Gamaliel's feet. But forgetting for a moment that Paul contradicted himself in the book of Acts when he stood up on the stairs to promote his religious credentials, he undermined his credibility in the 13th and 14th statements in this letter, when he spoke of his practice of Judaism, stating that he continued to progress in the practice of Judaism over and beyond any of his contemporaries, and that he was excessively enthusiastic to conform to the traditions and teachings handed down by his forefathers. So while it is possible to have been taught by both men and God, learning from each, Paul has both emphatically denied and enthusiastically embraced human teaching. And the notion that he was taught by God can only be considered valid if he, a known liar, is considered trustworthy. Moreover, the teachings of God, his Torah, Paul has condemned. So then now in Galatians 1:16, when Paul finally tells the truth, it only makes the situation worse. It is obviously true that he did not ask the advice of or consult with flesh and blood, but only because the Agelos messenger prodding him and controlling him was, by his own admission, Satan's messenger. Satan is not flesh and blood. It should also be noted that Paul's unique path was completely unlike, if I may use the errant versions of some of the names for a moment to make a point, Adam, Enoch, Noah, Job, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Aaron, Yahusha, Samuel, David, Ezra, Nehemiah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Joel, Jonah, Hosea, Zechariah, Malachi, Daniel, Yahusha, or Yahusha. Disciples, none of whom received any religious training. All of those witnesses on behalf of Yahweh and his purpose received no religious training. None of them, not even a speck of it. And what did Paul do? That's what he's bragging about. All of his religious training. He not only said he got religious training from the best religious teacher, but that he was his best student. Well, that's completely unlike everybody else that matters. There was nothing for these other individuals to reject or unlearn as a consequence. And perhaps that is the reason behind Paul's conflicting story. There is no denying that he continued to be extremely religious. And it is especially difficult for religious people to deal with the truth, because they first have to abandon most everything they have valued. Then they have to change their attitude, their perspective, and their thinking. Very, very few overtly religious people are capable of doing so. Paul wasn't. It was the antithesis of those who had previously spoken for Yahweh. He invested a considerable portion of his life promoting his credentials, becoming religious. Most new religions grow out of old religions. Buddha's teachings were considered viable because they grew out of Hinduism, the most popular religion in that part of the world at the time. Muhammad's Quran derives all of its credibility from the Jewish Talmud, just as rabbis surreptitiously usurped their authority from the Torah. Religions are seldom made out of whole cloth, but instead are a patchwork of previous traditions. Paul was creating Christianity out of Judaism. And that is what makes them so seductive and ultimately popular. There are a few better examples of one religion growing out of another than Pauline Christianity. It is also interesting to note that with both Christianity and Islam, their interpretation became, their inspiration, I should say, became their enemy. Muslims turned on the rabbis who had provided the many hundreds of Talmud citations which were bastardized and plagiarized to form the Quran. This happened because the Jewish rabbis could prove that they, not Allah, had served as Muhammad's inspiration, so he turned on them, calling them the foe. Similarly, I suspect that Shaul turned on Judaism because had he not done so, it would have become obvious that he had stolen both their strategy and their style. Shakespeare wrote the line in Hamlet, "The lady doth protest too much, methinks," to convey what's occurring here. By vociferously repeating his denial, we know that more than anything else, Paul wanted his audience to believe what we know to be untrue, that his message came directly from God as opposed to from men. In truth, had Paul been telling the truth, he didn't need to convey any of this ad nauseum. Yahweh had long ago established the method for us to determine who spoke for him and who did not, and the credentials of the individual, their past, meant nothing. The credibility of the individual is always irrelevant when it comes to God. That's why I do this show under the name Yada as opposed to my own name. I'm sharing what God shared. Therefore, my credibility is absolutely irrelevant. The past of Abraham is irrelevant to the relationship that Yahweh formed with him that became the covenant. We know nothing of it. Hosea's past, Yahshua, Isaiah's past, Yirmiyah, Jeremiah's past, Malachi, Malachi's past, are all irrelevant. Noah's past is irrelevant. They're not told to us because they aren't relevant. We actually know very little about Moshe's past. I mean, we know that his mother put him in a basket to float down the Nile, and he was taken out of the Nile, which is how he got his name, to be drawn out. That just tells you the basis of his name. We know that he was raised within the Pharaoh's household, and that he rebelled against the abuse being perpetrated against the Jews by Pharaoh. But other than that, we don't know nothing. We don't know what he did. Because Moshe's credibility is irrelevant. It is true of all of Yahweh's witnesses. The credibility of the spokesperson is irrelevant. It's only the credibility of the one that they're speaking for that matters. And Yahweh demonstrates his credibility through prophecy, through precisely accurate statements, for being consistent over the whole fabric of time and circumstance. So what Paul is doing here is completely inconsistent with everyone who has ever spoken for God, trying to prove his credibility. And he has none. And that's the amazing thing here, is not only is he about the wrong task, about demonstrating his credibility as opposed to letting God speak for him and letting God demonstrate the credibility of his own testimony, everything Paul is saying is untrue, counterproductive. No one should trust this man. It's that obvious. Well, long ago established a method to determine who spoke for him and who did not. And that method does not mention the credibility of the spokesperson. Never once. Ever. You know, a friend of mine got a letter from a Christian apologist the other day, and the apologist was way too big time an operator to actually read anything at Richard's site. Richard's is the blessyahweh.com site, and said, you know, I want you to, I'm so and so and so and so, and I want you to summarize in you know, five sentences or less why you believe Christianity is wrong and who you are. And what gives you the basis for your opinion? My friend just wrote him back and said, what an idiot. Who I am is irrelevant. What God said is relevant. I'm not going to hand you a five-sentence summary of what God said or a five-sentence summary of why Christianity is wrong. And I most certainly am not going to defend my credibility or tell you who I am. I'm irrelevant. Everyone who is part of the covenant has that exact same attitude. I tell you, beginning of every one of my books, I'm irrelevant. If you're really concerned about who I am, then no matter, this is a waste of time for you. And you don't find anyone speaking on behalf of Yahweh, sharing Yahweh's testimony, ever once claiming that they're relevant, that their credibility matters. Now, I don't want to go off and squander credibility because, you know, we live in a world where people want to attack a message by assailing the messenger. So I'm not going to go off and try to deliberately say something stupid and to squander it. But I'm certainly not going to engage in a debate with anyone as to whether or not I should be trusted. In fact, in every one of my books, I say, don't trust me. Go do this research for yourself. Go verify all of this for yourself. It's easy to do. But not Paul. No, Paul wanted to provide us with his credentials, his claims of trustworthiness. And when someone gets into that mode, claiming to speak on behalf of God, they are lying 100% of the time. It's interesting that God actually chooses to use those who are the least impressive. For example, when Yahweh wanted to introduce his name to his children and introduce his word to his children, he picked a stutterer, Moshe. When Yahweh wanted to tell us how to properly observe the Torah and to teach us that observing the Torah was examining it and considering it and coming to understand who Yahweh is and what he's offering, he picked a man whose human behaviors were abysmal. He picks individuals who have no credibility to convey his testimony. It's what he's all about. I mean, Noah wasn't a shipbuilder, for crying out loud. I mean, think it through. Look who Yahweh chose to work with. Look at their faults, and you will find that the fault of the individual falls right at the heart of the job that they're being asked to do. And so by choosing to work with flawed and imperfect implements, Yahweh accomplishes two things that are very meaningful to him. One is the person conveying the message stays reliant. You know, and I was engaged to expose and condemn Islam, when I was engaged to expose and condemn Christianity, when I was engaged to reveal the truth about the Torah, I never once ever even considered the idea of being qualified. I remained reliant because I knew I wasn't qualified. And so choosing a flawed implement causes the implement to be reliant. Also, when Yahweh uses a dented and dirty tool to show how magnificent he is and what he's offering is, then his message and what he's offering shines all the brighter. You know, it's one thing if I have the most magnificent tool in the universe that I create something of value. But if I have to create something of value with a flawed implement, then I have to be so much better. And Yahweh chooses to do that. And he does it consistently. He didn't choose brilliant scholars to convey his message. When he picked disciples, they were fishermen, for crying out loud. The only common characteristic is that the people that he chose were willing to question the religion and societal customs that they had grown up in, and they were willing to go where the word leads. They were open-minded. And to a large degree, they were passionate. They were individuals who cared about what they were doing, who, you know, it's like in the first hour of this program today, I was angry, righteous indignation, passionate, because I care about the truth. I'm angered by people who lie, who deceive. Universally, those who convey Yahweh's testimony were passionate. God likes passionate people. And so when you're engaged with someone sharing Yahweh's testimony, there's some things that you can look at to verify whether or not this person is telling you the truth, that they're conveying what God had to say. One is what they're saying consistent with what God has told us that he had committed to writing? If it's not, and Paul's wasn't, you need to reject them. Number two, when this person conveys something from God, does what they say happen as they have shared it? Because God is always right in his prophecy. Paul was not. Does this individual step out of the way and say, what God says matters, who I am is irrelevant? Common characteristics of those who speak for Yahweh. So we can be assured, based upon the detailed presentation of what Yahweh had to say, about how we should go about determining whether or not something was inspired by God himself. And you'll find it in Dabarim 13 and 18. That as we go through that test in future programs, you will find that Paul cannot be trusted. And that his claims of inspiration vanish when he's held accountable to and set aside God's test. According to the Torah, there are three aspects to being an accurate, productive messenger. The first act is to call the audience. There is no reason to waste time speaking to religious individuals because the truth will simply bounce off their veneer of faith as they struggle desperately to cling to their beliefs. Next, the ground must be prepared around those who remain. For the seeds of truth to take root, religious swamps must be drained of their stagnant waters, and the weeds of deception must be pulled. In this regard, the most effective weed pullers and swamp drainers are those who are cognizant of the delusions which permeate our society and which have polluted so many people. This requires study. And speaking of preparation, we must come to understand Yahweh's Torah before we try to educate others. Simply stated, to share the truth, you must first come to know the truth. During my first pass through Paul's opening letter, I erroneously assumed that Paul had come to recognize the truth, that he knew that his forefathers had crafted counterfeit rules and rituals, known as the oral law, to compete with Yahweh's Torah. I had hoped, therefore, that rabbinic tradition had become his primary foe, thinking that he was motivated to expose and condemn the suffocating religious regulations which had enslaved his people. Ideally, I would have liked to have seen him differentiate between man's religious rights and the healing and beneficial message conveyed in the Torah. The one lived out in the history of the Messiah Yahusha, but alas, it was not to be. And since Paul's story is not going to turn out well, I thought I'd substitute my own journey from Christianity to the Torah. from religion to relationship, from believing to knowing, from faith to trust. I was once like Paul, in a way. In my youth, I was the youngest ordained ruling elder in the Presbyterian Church. I provided a keynote address while in my teens at the National Assembly on denominational reconciliation. I taught evangelism at a very young age. I devoured Christian literature at a prodigious rate. But a time came when I could no longer prop up my faith. There were so many obvious conflicts between religion and reason that I couldn't believe in Christianity anymore. The religion of my youth, I knew, was wrong, was erring. So a time came when I devoted my life to secular pursuits. As an entrepreneur, and with the help of others, I built a number of companies from business plans into corporations with sales exceeding hundreds of millions of dollars. I had the privilege of taking two of those companies public, and we'll continue with this in a moment. I was once a billionaire. Does it have any credibility in terms of what I'm writing? No. Absolutely not.
Well, if you're going to talk investments, it might.
Yeah, maybe if I'm going to talk investments, but not what we're talking about here. Having been an ordained ruling elder in the Presbyterian Church, does it add any credibility to this? No. Having graduated magna cum laude from one of the world's leading universities, does it add any credibility? Nope. None of it does. Having built three companies from ideas to millions of dollars in revenue, does that add any credibility? No. None of it does. It's irrelevant. And, well, I've got credentials that might impress people in various pursuits, but they certainly aren't impressive to God. They aren't meaningful as it relates to this message. You know, a year after having left the management of my last business, I found myself on the cover of an international publication, being publicly humiliated for things I hadn't even done. It was my moment, if you will, in the road to Damascus, but there were no flashing lights. Fortunately for me, as I wished it had been for Paul, all of my prior experiences, the successes and the failures, were refined in this crucible of life. It was then that a dear friend taught me to write, and together we wove a word picture of what had actually occurred in my last business. That story became the book called In the Company of Good and Evil. It's an interesting read if you're fascinated by human behavior and business, commerce, how to start and fund a business. Almost the moment we were done, a God I barely knew asked me if I'd be willing to do to Islam what I had erroneously anticipated Shaul having done to Judaism, exposing and condemning it based solely upon his religious texts. After a brief negotiation, my literary friend and I were off to Israel to ascertain the mindset of Islamic suicide bombers. It was immediately after September 11th, 2001. Our meeting with Al-Qaeda is retold in Tea with Terrorists. It was during this time that I began a journey which would lead me through the pages of the Torah directly to the covenant. I was willing to go where the words led, no matter how much those words were in conflict with what I had previously believed. Unlike Paul, who was already an expert on Jewish scriptural literature, in my quest to expose Muhammad, I had to find and study the oldest Islamic sources in order to effectively condemn the religion. But like Paul's alleged experience in Arabia, I actually spent 3 years preparing to engage in the spiritual battle against a satanic foe. The result of being immersed and the scriptures of mankind's most repulsive swamp led to the production of Prophet of Doom, Islam's terrorist dogma, in Muhammad's own words. I would invest ultimately 5 years of my life exposing and condemning Islam on behalf of Yahweh, doing nearly 3,000 hours of talk radio interviews before God finally let me know that we had accomplished what we set out to do. But we were not finished working together. Having known what it was like to be a Christian, having traveled in over 150 countries around the world, having learned how Islam corrupts its victims' ability to think, I was encouraged to engage in another mission. That was Yada Yah, a conversation with God. You'll find it at yadayah.com. Recognizing that I was utterly unqualified to contribute to what's known about God is perhaps one of the principal reasons that I was motivated to do so. Making flawed implements shine is one of Yahweh's specialties. It was manifest again in an introduction to God, introtogod.org, which I would encourage everyone listening to this program to consider. The first of those two books recounts Yahweh's scientific, historic, and especially prophetic testimony. It proves beyond any doubt that Yahweh exists, that he inspired his Torah and prophets. The second reveals who he is and what he wants. It introduces us to God so that we might come to know him and understand the covenant that he is inviting us to participate in.